It's our last local hero spotlight of the year. And what a year it's been for farming. We're with Phil Corman from CESA, the local hero folks, and Denise Barstow Manns from the legendary Barstow Farm and Dairy in South Hadley. Hadley officially,
Hadley
but pretty yeah. close though. You're
Very
getting
close.
Yeah.
Really not that far from the flood marker.
Yes. The old flood marker where you're driving down there and you see where the floods of what year was that, do you know?
1936 and 1938.
We've had a lot of sad dairy cow stories over the course of this last year, but Barstow is still a successful dairy farm story.
Thank you. Yes, we're still here. We've been here for 217 years, so we'll keep it going another 200, I hope.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the farm.
Yeah, so Barstow's Longview Farm was founded by my ancestors in 1806, and our motto is looking forward since 1806, so that's our commitment every day to our herd, our land, our workforce, our community, and our food system. We have 600 head. We milk 300 dairy cows. We're part of the Cabot AgriMart Cooperative. Cabot has 500 farm families in New England and New York, and we are very lucky to be one of them.
Yeah, so when you see the Cabot cheese and you're pretty much every supermarket know that that's a cooperative. Sometimes it's cheaper to get the big block of cheddar, and sometimes it's cheaper to get multiple little blocks of cheddar. Mm. Currently, my last grocery shopping experience, cheaper to get multiple little blocks. That has nothing to do with you, Denise Barstow Manns, except for the fact that it's some of your cow's milk that goes into that Cabot cheese.
I just appreciate that now they make a mac and cheese blend so I don't have to decide on my own. Ah. Sometimes I don't want to think about it.
Nice. Despite being a 200-plus-year-old farm, you are innovators in farming technology.
You know, I give a lot of farm tours, and I think people are really surprised by the amount of technology that we have on the farm. But technology makes it fundamentally better for our cows, our soil, and for our bodies. And I think when we talk about sustainability, having the next generation able to go out and work and not, you know, be home with a backache is really important.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, like, physically milked a cow old school?
You know, no, because when I was born, we had a milking parlor. In 2014, we did bring in robotic milkers. So now our cows milk themselves. They all have a collar on them, so it knows who they are, like an easy pass when they go into the robot. remembers the last time that she milked, how much milk she's going to give. And it just makes it so they can all be on their own schedules, which means that our animals are more comfortable more of the time. And every dairy farmer in the whole world knows that a comfortable dairy cow is going to give more milk and higher quality milk and probably not show up on the vet bill. So very important to our bottom line and to our animal care to have these robots.
Because the robots also track how healthy the cow is too, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of components to it. So, you know, it takes their weight, it takes their temperature, and then it also is giving them grain based on their last lactation. So it's very focused for each animal, individualized care. And if there's something going on that we should know about, it'll send us a text message, like check in on Henrietta or whoever.
How do the cows text with their hooves? I can't even, like, do it with my regular human thumbs.
No.
We're talking with Denise Barstow Manns from Barstow Farm in Hadley, a big, I don't want to call it ancient, but it's certainly old operation here in the valley over 200 years.
So I think there's two aspects that come to my mind when I think about the farm. One is that, like many businesses that have been trying to be going for over 200 years, Barstow's has had to adapt to continue to be financially sustainable. And then the other part is how much agricultural land it's steward. I'd love to hear you talk about those two things.
You know, in the early 2000s, the milk market really crashed on everyone. So we sat down as a family and talked about what we wanted to do to diversify and bring in more revenue streams so that we could continue farming. And so one of those things was opening up Barstow's Dairy Store and Bakery. We opened that up in 2008. And, you know, we kind of opened it to be the front door of our farm, Save the Farm. And it's really become this, like, time capsule for family recipes and this important gathering place for our community where we can have this ongoing conversation about food. Right now, my cousins are up to their eyeballs in bakery orders for Christmas, for the holidays, and we will still have, you know, extras. So if you forgot to put your order in, we've got pies, we've got cookies, we've got cheesecakes ready to go.
You know, it's so great that you're selling local milk that's not your own. Can you just talk a little bit about why some dairies need to process their own milk and other dairies like yours are very clear that selling wholesale is a much better model for your family?
Yeah. On our farm, we don't do our own processing. We sell it all wholesale to the Cabot Creamery Cooperative. And that really works for us because we can just focus on farming, taking care of our girls, and they can focus on moving it around, doing all the marketing, all the processing, bottling. So that's what works for us. And if there was someone in the next generation that really wanted to do their own bottling, then maybe that would be something that we would consider. But every dairy farm is like its own little science project, right? We're all making milk, but we're all doing it a little bit differently. And I think that that makes a really resilient food system, is to have that diversity in all these different farms.
How many generations are currently working at Barstow's?
We're a sixth and seventh generation owned and operated farm. And the eighth generation is running around getting into trouble.
Are there members of like five and four still kicking around doing some stuff on the farm?
There was when I was a kid. Yeah, my grandfather was on the farm and my great uncle John. But I think that the crazy thing about farming is it's so entrenched in legacy. Like, we are talking about Septimus, who came here in 1806. What a name, right? Who founded the farm.
I wonder what number of child he was.
Actually, weirdly not related to that. He wasn't even born in September.
Like, is he the ninth child, though? Or seventh?
What is a Septimus?
Septimus is his name, but like he's not the seventh child. He's not born in September.
I thought that was like their religion. No, we were Septimus, so we had to leave England and come over.
Optimist.
He's Septimus. I'm like, okay, so he's the seventh kid. Go ahead.
That's where I would have gone to.
Right? Yeah, I have a deviated Septimus.
No,
I can barely breathe at this point.
No.
But you know, still going, looking backwards 200 years at Barstow's, and then looking forward in the future, you have these huge digesters on the farm there. Can you tell us about what those are and do?
Yeah, we have an anaerobic digester. It's a system that takes the energy potential out of cow manure and food waste, and it turns it into enough electricity to power 1,600 homes. So we're getting food waste from local food producers like Cabot, Coca-Cola. We get stuff from Whole Foods. We get grease trap waste from local restaurants. And we also have plenty of manure from our cows. And that all commingles in a digester, which works a lot like a stomach. So it's really warm in this big tank, and everything's moving around. And there's microbes that break down that food waste, that cow manure, and make methane gas. So we're capturing all of that and running it through these engines, which turns a generator and makes electricity that goes off to the grid. And we're only using about 4% of what we produce on the farm. So the vast majority of it is going right out into Hadley, South Hadley, and Amherst.
That's amazing.
How did that idea come about? Because I don't know if any other farms are doing anything to that scale with this sort of anaerobic digesters to create electricity.
I think there's seven farms maybe in the state that have methane digesters. Some of them kind of learn from each other and work together to bring in an outside, because you can't run this yourself.
Right. Oh, so that's somebody else kind of runs that whole thing?
Yes. Yeah. So again, like, so we can focus on farming. We do work with Vanguard Renewable Energy, and they do all the operations and day-to-day of the digester. So that's all the maintenance, all the food waste contracts, the chemistry. There's a lot that goes into it, and we want to make sure that we're always capturing that methane, not letting it go, making that electricity that's going out to the grid as green renewable energy.
So I made the mistake of asking you two questions at the same time. The second half was around, you have 600 head, 300 being milked. How much acreage do you need to raise and produce the milk from those cows?
So we're making it work with 450 acres. We would love more to have more diversity in our feed, and also just to take some of the pressure off of if the 160 acres happen to be underwater like it was on July 10th, that we can be a little more resilient in the face of those climate crises. So 450 acres, actually most of it we don't own, a lot of it we lease, and we do everything that we can for soil and making sure that we have healthy soils on that land. So soil is, you know, as important as our animal health, because the soil is sustaining our family and our cows and our community. It's a natural resource that's so important that soil is well cared for. So farmers are stewards of the land, and we take that job very seriously on the farm. We use cover crops to keep all of that soil in the ground all winter when it's really wet and raining and windy. We have a riparian buffer along our streams and the Connecticut River, which is great for a flooding buffer and minimizing erosion. It's also a really important wildlife corridor to have that. We also use 100% no-till farming practices on the farm. Tillage is the act of turning the soil every year in the spring. It makes it very nice and easy to plant in, but we know that you're disrupting the soil when you do that tillage process. And there's a lot of good stuff that is alive in the soil, and we know that things that are alive have carbon in them. So if we can keep more things alive in the soil, we're going to sequester more carbon in the ground. We use a no-till planter, and it brings along a blade. It drops the seed at the measured level and covers that seed behind it. So that's a very low-touch way of farming.
We're speaking with Denise Barstow-Mans from Barstow's Farm in Hadley. We have mentioned a little bit about the floods. Looking back on 2023, it's probably the top agricultural story, the climatological devastation. You mentioned over 100 acres of yours were underwater. What else happened during those floods, and how have the programs that were created in the aftermath helped Barstow's?
Having the Connecticut River come up was, you know, surprising in a lot of ways, because there wasn't much we could do besides just watch it come. So we had about 160 acres underwater. Most of it was corn. We lost 40 acres outright, so we just cut it down and disposed of it. And then we probably lost an additional 40 acres just to having it be way low quality. So there was rot in there, mycotoxins. It's a plant disease, so that's going to stick around in the soil for crop yields to come, unfortunately. And then we, because of the rain that followed it, we lost our entire second cutting of hay and almost all of our third cutting of hay, and we usually get 4 or 5 per year. So it was a big loss, and also we weren't alone, so hay prices are very expensive. We had a lot of folks to compete with for pricing. It was a big, big blow to the farm. It was a tough year for us.
So what about the Massachusetts Farm Resiliency Fund? What about the money from the legislature? How much of that has helped you?
It has helped, right? So we have no idea how many farms would have had to shut their doors if that kind of opportunity wasn't available. The disaster relief funding, there was the Farm Resiliency Fund, which was made up mostly from philanthropists, which is amazing. We have such a supportive community here in Massachusetts. And then, you know, CESA has their emergency fund, which is a zero interest loan. So all of that pooled together is going to make it so that a lot of our local farms can last, which is just so essential to food security.
When we talked with Ashley Randall, from the Mass Department of Agricultural Resources, she said she didn't know of any farms that were not going to continue from this year to next. So that's really good news.
And part of the insanity of farmers.
Yeah.
Which we kind of rely on in a way for our food to
get
to
our... kind of?
And it's just so important, I think, that while everyone gave was being so generous, we need to understand that it did not even cover half of the losses that farms experienced. And it means they're entering next year in a tough position with, again, unknown weather going to be happening. So there's been one farmer who has suggested that we support firefighters and police officers. And they're just essential municipal roles. And maybe we need to start thinking about how we support farmers, because it seems like that's kind of an essential role, too. Mm.
Would you say that it's harder because people don't necessarily understand some of the extra steps that especially raising livestock takes?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of challenges that livestock farmers get to face because we have living, breathing animals that need our attention every day, you know, not just during the growing season. It's every single day. You know, with climate change, heat stress is a really big thing that we're concerned about. And, you know, ahead of those floods, we were looking at some of the hottest days on record. And it was really tough on our farm workers. It's not safe for them. And it's also really tough on the cows. They're 1,500-pound animals. It's really hard for them to bring their temperature down if they get too hot. So we put a lot of infrastructure into place to make sure that they're staying comfortable. We've got sprinklers, we've got fans, we have a curtain system that automatically goes up or down to bring in the wind. There's only so much we can do. We try to keep everything about our cows' routine consistent, you know, the care, the milking program, the food quality, and also the temperature, but that one is certainly the hardest one to keep the same all the time.
So as we were driving in for this interview, you were mentioning, Denise, when we were talking about holidays, and you mentioned that it's really good that your dad can work on Christmas Day so no one else has to.
Thanks, Dad!
Yeah. My immediate family, we do our Christmas on the 27th. And yes, a lot of the farmhands are still there. It's not just my dad all alone on Christmas Day. But it is kind of nice that on Christmas morning, my dad is available.
Why does your dad have to do it?
He does.
Are you just asking for dads?
Yeah, it's just dad.
Yeah, dads united.
Did he volunteer? Like he hates Christmas? Like he doesn't celebrate Christmas?
So my day-to-day is actually at Varso's Dairy Store and Bakery, so that's closed on Christmas.
Denise Barstow-Mans from Barstow's Dairy and Bakery and an anaerobic digester and 600 head of cattle dairy farm. Hopefully 2024 fares better for you and all of the farmers in the area. But if not, organizations like CESA, the local hero folks, and the community writ large here in the fabulous 413 are around to try to have your back as best we can. You can find out about all of our local heroes at buylocalfood.org.
Shout out to my ex-roommate just there who used to work with you.
According to Denise Barstow-Mans, this year has brought us remarkably close to meeting and perhaps surpassing the amount of flooding that led to that marker we talked about. And if you're in Hadley and know the specifics of those numbers, drop us a line at thefab413@nepm.org. We are curious and alarmed.
Up next, 7 days, 7 principles, and a lot more ways to connect with the self and the community as we learn about Kwanzaa.
You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on NEPM.